It's been a while, hasn't it? Good morning, everybody. I am Art Bell, and this is The Weekend. Richard C. Hoagland is a former Space Science Museum curator, a former NASA consultant, and during the historic Apollo missions to the moon, was science advisor to Walter Cronkite and CBS News. For over 20 years, Hoagland has been leading an outside scientific team and a critically acclaimed independent analysis of possible intelligently designed artifacts on Mars. Richard and his team's investigations have been quietly extended to include over 30 years of previously hidden data from NASA, Soviet, and Pentagon missions to the moon. So in a moment, and it has been a long time, Richard C. Hoagland. Richard, I've looked very carefully, and all I see is rocks. Oh. Wait a minute. We're going to talk about bees.
We're going to come back to that at some point, I guess. Good evening, Art.
Good evening.
Or good morning, whatever the case may be.
More the case than not across the U.S., yes.
You have had many journeys, my friend.
That I have, he says.
Yes. Well, I am terrifically happy that we're doing this tonight because I think you're going to enjoy it. I think I'm going to enjoy it. And I think our audience definitely is going to enjoy it. In fact, they might want to record it. This might be one of those, you know, for the books.
Well, perhaps so. You're going to make a case, or you're going to try to make a case, that the bee mystery is somehow traces back to hyperdimensional physics, right?
I didn't start out from that position. I, like everybody else, have been kind of following this story, and I don't keep bees, and I don't know people that keep bees. And I've, you know, one of those, I mean, there's so much going on. This planet is going through such changes. I just listened to you with Evelyn, and it's marvelous that you have her on because she definitely does have her heart in the right place. And whoever that turkey was who made that stupid accusation should be ashamed of himself.
Well, you know, they couldn't make the accusation that she was inaccurate, so they're left to that.
Well, there are desperate people who really can't handle, is that old line from A Few Good Men, they can't handle the truth.
Right.
And we're dealing in a situation where there's a rising curve of changes in every direction. I mean, you called it, I don't know how you did it, you probably have sources, but you wrote a whole book called The Quickening.
Mm-hmm.
Pointing toward exactly what we're looking at now and what we're going to be seeing in a rising curve as we get closer to this nodal point, this date of 2012. And I there are times when I say to myself, how the heck did he know? Because when you and I started talking about stuff, which was, what, 10, 15 years ago?
Sure.
We were at the very beginning. You had to really have your radar way out there on the distant time horizon to note that life was not going on as it had been.
And intuition. Intuition, Richard. That's all it was. Intuition.
Well,
I felt it coming.
I mean, you're at the center of a spider web. If anybody in those years was going to get an early warning jiggle in the spider web, it would have been you.
Right.
Because you've created this incredible experiment, this grand family, this, as Peter Jennings once called it, the national campfire. Of course, he wasn't talking about your show. He was talking about media in general during crises. And I think he was talking about ABC right after 9/11, but it applies so much more to what you and George do because, you know, the really bright people are awake now. They're up at night. They are night people. They are sensitive. They're able to look at other things minus the distractions of life. You know that old cliche, life is what happens when you're making plans?
That's right.
And it's those people who, in synchronization with you at the center of the spider web, were aware long before the rest of the culture that life would not go on as we have been used to life going on.
No, it will not.
And now we're seeing this ascending, almost asymptotic, almost right through the roof curve of change every day. When I get up, you know, which of course is not in the early morning anymore, you have ruined my life, Art. The first thing I do is I turn on, you know, MSNBC or CNN or whatever.
Oh, you become a night person.
Well, yeah, because it's also easier to work. When you're trying to do intellectual things, you're trying to think, when you're trying to figure out problems and put pieces together. And
much better at night.
The dots. The night, you know, I took a little walk outside here where we are in New Mexico, and it's a stunning night. There's brilliant Venus, and there's a, you know, we can see down the valley in twinkling lights and stars. And I mean, it's nighttime is when real thinking can be done, and that's where this vast coast to coast. I mean, think of yourself in space, Art, looking down at the planet and looking down at the entire United States from sea to shining sea, except, of course, at night they don't shine. What's shining is all the lights of all those cities, representative of the consciousness of all the people who are listening to us right now, all connected. So the logical extension of you being in the center of the spider web was to use the web to do important things. I mean, you know my position that I wouldn't be here talking to you if you hadn't used the spider web to benefit me.
And you were one of the, yeah, that's true.
A bunch of other stuff. And it's interesting what Evelyn said, because part of what I want to talk about this evening is how this physics that I have been discussing for so many years involves this consciousness field, this ability to link minds in a coherent, resonant fashion to accomplish extraordinary things. And as we get into this series of changes, as the years go by and more things happen that we don't want to see happen, I really think that this audience is going to have to basically shoulder the mantle of taking responsibility for trying to make positive change.
It may well come to that. Before you go on, Richard, I really miss Peter Jennings. As you know, I was in the last
major
special
show, yeah.
Yeah, that he did. And I'm convinced that had he lived, there would have been follow-ups. That was but a first tentative big step on the part of a network, and I think that he had plans to go further had he lived.
Well, it was a very peculiar special because it had elements for debunkers, but it also had areas that they focused on that if it had been just a simple rip-and-read show, they would not have focused on. And I saw it, like you, as a kind of an experimental toe in the water to see who stood up and saluted, to mix our metaphors madly here. And he was taken away from us much, much too soon.
Yeah. There was no way that program, of course, was ever going to satisfy ufology. No way in the world. But it was not for that audience. It was for the larger audience. And it was a little baby step, and
exactly,
a good one. And I'm convinced he would have taken it farther. At any rate, we are now in the middle of a real mess. The number of bees missing.
Well, I've done a calculation, and, you know, the average commercial beekeeper, I found out a lot about bees in the last few weeks. I now know more about bees than I ever thought I would ever know in my entire life. The thing that's significant is the commercial bee people, and I didn't know this before I got into it. Beekeeping used to be a hobby. It used to be, you know, some folks that had a couple of hives or a farm. You know, I grew up in farm country, so I knew about people who kept bees. But it's turned into, as most other things in our society are, have turned into, it's turned into a corporation.
Yeah.
It's turned into mass production. And they have, some of these beekeeping farms have literally thousands of hives. And each hive can contain between 20,000 and 80,000 bees, each in wooden enclosure. And when you start trucking these around the country and you have to feed them sugar water and you know, alternate food to get them from point A to point B, then they put them out on these farms so they will pollinate like the almond crop. And what was striking to me is that it was the mass-produced, domesticated, corporate bee that is suffering this stunning, catastrophic whatever first. And you made such a perceptive comment a few weeks ago as you began to notice the depth and severity of this.
Mm-hmm.
You asked one crucial question that really got me thinking, which was, where are all the little bee bodies?
That's right.
With their six legs sticking up in the air. And that was such an image. I mean, if you were to kill the bees in an average hive, you'd have 30, 40, 50,000 bodies.
Right.
Now, we have gone through previous, I found out, epidemics of bee disasters back in the 50s and the 70s. there were major waves of catastrophic bee die-offs, where the beekeepers would come out and they would find hives full of dead bees, bees stacked around the hives, dying of pesticides and the mites and the parasites that basically attacked them. That's not what's going on with this crisis. This is so X-Files. This is so Chris Carter. This is so, if I may use the term, Star Trek. This is like, Art, someone basically said, Scotty, beam them up.
Yeah.
And they're all gone. And what's interesting and even weirder is that normally when hives have these problems, they're full of honey, right? And they're
Correct.
Full of little bees and pupae and larvae and, you know, the bee life cycle is going on. And so you've got this city of bees minus the bees. If they abandon the hive, if they swarm and go away, leaving a few and the queen and all that, they will be attacked by predators in the surrounding ecosystem very quickly. There are worms and there are moths and there are little guys waiting to move in to that incredible rich source of energy, the honey, to basically eat it.
Yeah, one of my callers nailed it. He said it's like the bees have been raptured.
Exactly. It's beam me up, you know, Scotty. And what's weird is that the hives are not the focus of predators moving in to steal what's left when the workers are all away. They are left alone. Now, what other phenomenon in the phenomenology that you have covered all these years has the same earmarks of a, quote, eco-crime where predators do not move in to take advantage of the crime? Can you think of one?
Well, sure. For example, a cow that has been taken up and then dropped. Predators don't touch
cattle
it.
Mutilations.
That's right.
Bingo. I knew you'd get it. Now, don't you find that parallel stunning?
Maybe. In other words, we don't have little bee bodies that are untouched by any sort of predators or anything of that sort.
No. The bees have just disappeared.
Now,
I also think that some of these swarms, I mean, we're putting up something on the web tonight. Soon as I can find my web guy, David Wilcock and I have been working this problem jointly. David is a brilliant guy in terms of physics. His intuition is matched only by his resourcefulness and his ability to do real research. Well, he has put together, and I have put together, this overview of a series we're putting up on Enterprise beginning tonight, which will be posted maybe sometime during the show, if not, then certainly tomorrow. And I was doing some tail-end work, and I started looking at some of the weird phenomenology around the edges of this mystery. We're finding a lot more bees showing up in strange places where bees have no business being, pun intended. Like a few days ago, they had a 60,000 bee swarm basically show up and camp out at City Hall in downtown Spokane, Washington. They had a similar group show up in a hospital in Little Rock, Arkansas. It would have been more interesting if it had been the Rose Law Firm, but they didn't do that. They went to the hospital. And what that's telling me, or at least it's potentially suggestive, is that the bees aren't dying, Art. They're lost.
They're lost, yeah.
They
a lot of people have suggested
that. Their way home.
That's right.
And what happens is two bees get together and say, hey, tell everybody, meet us in the corner of Elm and Central. And they all show up to try to do their normal bee thing, which is very social. You know, bees are incredibly social, and they want to get together. They can't live apart. I mean, I one of my musings was I can imagine this little bee leaving the hive, the worker, going out to do its thing with the flowers and all that, and it can't get back. What does it do? How does it function, and for how long can it live all on its own? Well, if you take, for instance, one commercial carrier that I know had something like 27 million bees disappear in the space of a couple of days. Now, that sounds like a lot of bees, right?
Yeah.
But if you spread them out through several square miles and think of the number of square feet there are in a square mile, it turns out that you wouldn't even notice the bees
perhaps
in that space, even millions of them. And globally, if we do a rough calculation, about a billion, more or less, give or take, bees have disappeared in the Northern Hemisphere between here
and
Europe.
A lot of bees.
Richard,
Einstein is quoted as saying that 4 years after the bees are gone, so will go humanity. What do you think he based that on?
Well, first of all, he never said it.
He didn't know.
That is an urban legend. Let me nail that one right to the floor right now. That is an interesting myth that's been going around. I don't know who coined it. It obviously was designed to get our attention. It got your attention because you used it several times.
Oh, yes.
How we know that it never happened is that there are some assiduous folks like at, website? Snopes. You know, looks up legends, urban legends.
Yes.
No one can find any references in any of Einstein's letters, papers, documents, public speeches to bees. Zero. None. Yeah. Zip. Nada. He never said it. But the sentiment is, in fact, true. It's almost like somebody who knew that they could only get publicity if they used a famous name, put this out and the net spread it, you know, all around the world without the bees. In our you know, ecosystem in the United States alone, it turns out that about a third of the food that we consume, particularly fruits and vegetables and apples and stuff like that, comes from bee pollination.
Mm-hmm.
If we lost the bees,
yes,
the domestic honeybee, the big commercial farms
disappear,
then our entire food chain will be extraordinarily negatively impacted. And it will ripple. It's not linear. It's not like, oh, well, I can live without apples. It's the subtleties. Remember, these are all interrelated systems, and you cannot predict a linear cause and effect if something of this magnitude takes hold. And at the moment, the only ray of good news, and this is something we'll obviously get into in the next half hour, is that the only honeybees, well, let me back up. The only bees that seem to be radically affected like this,
the wild ones,
are the corporate bees.
Corporate bees. I heard that organic bees are not disappearing now.
Not at all. And there was another clue. And, you know, we don't have time now between now and the bottom of the hour, but you know, as I promised tonight, I'm going to provide not only what the cause seems to be from our research, but what the solution can be. And the only problem is that the solution is we require both sides, and there's two sides in this human equation, to come together and to make peace with each other, because they haven't for years. They've been fighting for years, political fights that I found out about in terms of doing this research. Mm. There are two camps, and they don't talk to each other. They each accuse the other of doing terrible things to bees and, you know, not using practices that are acceptable, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They're going to have to come together. These two sides, the commercial bee farmers and the organic bee farmers, are going to have to basically, you know, lay down the whatever you want to call it, the gauntlet, put down the gauntlet and come to the table and together craft a solution. Because it turns out the organic beekeepers, even though they don't know yet what they know something that will solve this crisis.
So they're going to have to form a hive mentality.
That's right. They will have to form a social system patterned on the little creatures that they live upon.
All right. Well, look, what's the difference between the way the organic bees are maintained and handled and the way the big corporate manipulators do what they do? In other words, therein has got to lie the answer.
Well, the first clue I had was in an article in The Economist, which is the first paper listed or the first reference listed in our bee paper that will be posted. Because The Economist made, again, I knew nothing about how bee stuff went on until I started researching. And what I found is that we have this incredible migratory corporate Henry Ford assembly line approach to where they truck millions of bees on big, you know, semis, flatbeds.
Right.
From farm to farm, and they truck them across half the country. You will have a huge semi full of bees from Alabama going to the almond fields in California.
All right. We will be right back. Richard C. Hoagland is my guest. I'm Art Bell. Here I am indeed. Well, all right, I've heard the same thing. It's going around the Internet. There are a lot of statements by organic bee handlers that organic bees are not affected. That said, the big masses of them that, as Richard pointed out, are carried on semis around the country are affected. So I guess that begs a couple of questions. One that comes to mind immediately is, we've been doing that for years and years and years. If the bees were going to object to be being carted about by semis for commercial purpose, it seems to me they would have made that objection or that miscalculation or that inability to find home apparent years ago. What has changed? We'll be right back. Well, all right, Richard, before you say anything, let me read this to you. United Press International, dated May 10th. A NASA study suggests that global warming may raise average summer temperatures in the eastern United States by 10 degrees Fahrenheit by the 2080s. National Aeronautics and Space Administration scientists determined that eastern U.S. summer daily high temperatures that currently average in the low to mid 80s Fahrenheit will most likely soar into the low to mid 90s by the 2080s. But during seasons with infrequent rainfall, July and August, daily temperatures could average between 100 and 110 degrees in cities like Chicago, Washington, and Atlanta. Now, that process is underway right now, Richard. Whatever it is that's causing it, the process is certainly underway. And perhaps the bees, as somebody emailed me at the beginning of the program, are already being affected by this, and they're going north. Just a thought, Richard.
That's an interesting idea. We should talk to Canada.
Well, it's funny you should mention that. That's where the email came from, was Alberta.
Interesting.
Where he said they've got bees all over the place.
Well, as I said, it was the article in The Economist that got me really thinking that we might have a you know, kind of a trek here on what could be going on. Because this idea that the hives are trucked from state to state and farm to farm,
right?
You know, it's hard enough to find your way home when you stay put. But can you imagine a little bee that uses environmental cues solely being trucked in covered hives, you know, thousands of miles, 2,000 miles, for instance, set out in the fields in a totally strange place? If something were interfering with their navigation system,
okay.
If something were changing the environment, because you,
but
would
it would have to be something recent, Richard,
absolutely.
Because they've been doing this for years.
Absolutely, that's where the major clue comes in. So, you know, David and I and a couple other people that we're working with on this started comparing notes, and I said, you know, it's got to be what I've been saying all along, possibly a change in the physics. So I started doing bee research. I started looking up, you know, websites and looking at people who've been, you know, working with bees all their lives, who've done exquisite literature searches, who have massive databases on their sites going back literally hundreds of years to where bees were domesticated. I mean, you know, the domestic honeybee is not native. It comes from Europe. It was brought over in the 1600s. And it was first domesticated in Europe, and actually it was domesticated originally in Egypt. You know, we have data going back that far, and the practices have not really changed very much up until the last couple hundred years. A couple hundred years out of thousands of years that man has lived with bees.
Even so, that's a long time.
So I started looking at, well, what have we been doing? What could what beekeepers have been doing be in contradiction to what bees would like to be doing? Because this this crucial piece of data that the natural bees, the wild, the feral bees they're called, as well as the organic bees that are raised by humans but under, quote, natural conditions, and we'll get into what that means in a minute, that they're unaffected by this. This is only affecting the what I call the corporate hives, the mass transit bees, the ones that are trucked around, and the ones that live in these, you know, artificial environments. What do they do? What do those guys do that the natural folks don't do? Well, the first thing I found out was that the corporate hives are dusted and fumigated and pesticided and basically sprayed within an inch of their lives.
Right.
And the reason is that in their corporate world, they are attacked by all kinds of outside parasites that are trying to devour them, trying to eat them, particularly these tracheal mites and this Sporoa mite, which came in the 1950s, around 57, I think, from Asia. Those are the two biggest problems of the corporate domesticated bee mass production guys, is these exterior basically parasites, attackers, that are trying to eat what's in the hive, including the bees. Mm-hmm. And the only way that those guys, you know, attack back is they use fungicides and pesticides and, you know, all kinds of techniques to basically try to keep the wrong guys out and the good guys' immune system supported, which, of course, is doing exactly the opposite.
And they are claiming that the immune system they feel is affected, right, of the bee?
Well, when they go to these hives, this is now the people at the University of Pennsylvania, who is one of the centers for this developing catastrophic response to this crisis, has originated. When they go to the hives where nobody's home except for a queen and a few workers and a lot of little bees that are still in the honeycomb about to be born, and they take bees out and they sample them, they find they're riddled with these parasites and disease. Now, they're claiming that maybe it's a parasitic thing. I've seen, news stories that it's a viral thing. I saw, remember the news story that it was cell phones?
Cell phones, yeah, sure, all kinds of things.
That from the study in Germany. Everybody has got their oar in the water here, and nobody really knows. You know, there's like the fad of the couple-day club, where a scientist or a group of scientists will come up and say, I have a friend call me tonight, who, by the way, her name is Lee, and she is having a birthday, so everybody wish Lee Chin a happy birthday. She called me with a study that she sent me from, I think, London, claiming that it's a genetically modified foods, that they're the culprit.
All right.
The problem is that the food source, the viral environment, the pesticide environment, the parasite environment, everything is the same art for the domestic bees, the feral bees, the organic bees, and the corporate bees.
But that's
only
what I
thought. The corporate
ones,
and I'm using that kind of over term because they're basically big companies that truck these things around, they're the ones radically suffering. So what is it that makes them the target when all the other bees eat the same food, are exposed to the same pests?
Yeah, and why now?
And why now?
They've been carted around like this for many years.
So you go back to what has changed in the environment that the corporate bees cannot withstand, and the natural bees and the organic domestic bees are withstanding perfectly fine.
Right.
And that's where the incredible aha, the light bulb went on. And it has to come back to the physics. Because I got deeper into this, I started realizing that it was, remember that line when Clinton was running, it's the economy stupid?
Mm-hmm.
It's the geometry stupid. Look at a beehive. Look at a honeycomb. What do you see? A honeycomb is composed of very regular cells that are hexagonal, right?
Correct.
And what is a hexagon? It's in two dimensions. It's two interlocked tetrahedrons.
Right.
And so I started thinking, okay, is there potentially a connection between bees disappearing, mites attacking them, honeycomb geometry, and you're going to love this one, the Great Pyramid?
Honeycomb geometry is consistent whether they're organic or trucked about.
Ah, but it isn't. That's what I found. It's not. It's the same geometry, but what the corporate folks have done, and they basically done it out of the profit motive, to make the bee industry more productive, more successful, more above the bottom line versus below the bottom line, all that stuff. Starting a couple hundred years ago, they started turning out on machines what they call foundation, which is basically an artificial template where you have a machine that in a matrix, probably metal, it can be plastic now, they stamp out what's called foundation honeycomb.
Okay.
And the bees, they put this in these wooden structures, the hives, and the bees build their natural honeycomb with wax. products on this foundation. It's like a template.
I can understand how that would add to the bottom line, cut some time off the B building and all the rest of it. But
it's even more interesting.
But this has been going on for a couple hundred years, so why is it just showing up now?
Well, this is where things get really interesting. That's why, as part of our program tonight, I wanted to do some background on the physics and how the physics intersects with this problem slash solution. So it turns out that a couple hundred years ago, they started building this standard honeycomb, you know, putting it in the bees in the artificial farms, and the bees would build on it. They noticed that the honeycomb that they were making was bigger than the natural honeycomb of the wild bees. And then they noticed something even more intriguing, that bigger honeycomb seemed to beget bigger bees.
Mm-hmm.
Bigger bees have bigger legs, bigger wings. They can fly farther. They can forage better. They have more energy. They have longer proboscises, which are the tongues that dip into the nectar of the flower.
Right.
They can get at flowers that the little bees, the normal bees, as these guys saw it, couldn't get to. And the bottom line was they could produce, for a given number of bees, bigger bees, the theory was, would produce more honey, which you would then sell to make more money.
Sure.
Or in terms of the pollination side, where the bees are basically trucked around not to make honey but just to pollinate, they would be able to pollinate more fields faster per day than the smaller bees, that kind of thing. So you could charge more for bigger bees.
Hmm.
It turns out that that's the source of the problem, Art.
Because?
Because the bigger combs are somehow deleterious. They're somehow having an incredible negative influence now on the bees themselves.
Why now?
And they leave.
Yeah, why now?
Well, that gets back to what is the honeycomb doing? Remember, our model, the model of the hyperdimensional physics, is that reality in three dimensions is immersed in this constant sea of invisible waves in the ether, vibrating, sloshing back and forth, rippling out from rotating planets like little, pebbles that you drop in a pond, whatever. And it's the interaction of all these various spinning masses. It's all rotation, 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 all the way down to the atomic level, where things are in constant spinning motion, right?
Yes.
And it's the geometry of the honeycomb, which tends to amplify certain frequencies of this background field of invisible radiation. Now, I'm not talking electromagnetics. I'm not talking radio waves or whatever. I'm talking something even more fundamental that I discovered a couple of years ago as part of our ongoing research into how this physics worked. It turns out that there is a huge body of physics that's been hidden because of the Cold War from the West, where the Russians have done stunning, amazing, replicatable experiments, particularly one guy named Nicholas Kozarev we're going to talk about. And they're calling this whole field torsion field physics. Torsion is another word for spin and rotation. And when I got this data, which is on the web, and lots and lots of papers that have not been translated in that are in Russian that I would love to be able to read, but what's on there that has been translated was a stunning aha, because every experiment that I had thought of over the years to do to test the hyperdimensional model, it turns out the torsion field guys, starting with Nicholas Kozarev back in the 20s and 30s in the Stalinistic Soviet Union, had thought of and done. And when I got this data a couple of years ago, it was like a $10 million Christmas present. It was every experiment in hyperdimensional physics that Enterprise has never had the money to actually go out and be able to do. And it came to me by way of my dear friend David Wilcock, who is a brilliant guy. I mean, he saw this relationship between the Russian work and what I've been talking about before I did, and brought it to my attention. And that's why we have wound up working together. In fact, you and I and he did a program in May of 2000, the night that Jean Mayloff was murdered, where we talked about this physics and the climate change, which is going on not just on Earth, but all over the solar system, which is mandated by this fundamental systemic change in this background physics, in this relationship of the torsion fields of various spinning planets and the sun, and it even impacts life. it turns out that this torsion physics applies to everything we can see. It's the glue that knits together reality, including, as Evelyn Pagnini was saying in the first hour, consciousness. It's what you basically are tinkering with, Art, when you do these mass consciousness experiments. You synchronize the minds of the millions of Coast people, the Coast family that is listening to us right now. You get them in resonance. You then direct that resonance in the torsion field to accomplish something. And through an actual measurable physics, and the experiments are stunning. They're absolutely stunning. They're so predictive. They so explain what's going on in so many areas that look like they're separate, but they're really not. They're really connected. And so I started thinking, okay, geometry, bees, bee sizes, the physics changes. Because of economics, the commercial beekeepers have built bigger combs that make bigger bees. And it turns out that these bigger combs are very unhealthy places for bees to live. The stunning difference between the natural wild bees and or the organic bee farmers that use much smaller comb size as their foundation and the commercial guys is that the natural bees, the organic bees, don't have a mite problem, either the varroa or the trachea mites, which are the two banes of bee existence now in the last 30 or 40 years that are killing bees left and right unless you use massive doses of pesticides and fungicides and all kinds of basically, you know, pest killers.
But the one question you have not asked or answered yet is what has changed this year?
I think it is a frequency of the tone of the background physics that the combs, in fact, are amplifying. And I go back to what I said a moment ago about the Great Pyramid. Remember some years ago, I mean, you had a dozen people on talking about the Great Pyramid, and the one thing about the pyramid that everybody kind of agrees on is that, you know, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, somebody discovered dead cats were not decomposing in the pyramid.
I remember something about that.
They were getting in there, they were dying because they can't find their way out, and they have no food and water and all that, but they weren't decomposing. The reason, back engineering this, is that the frequency of the torsion field of the pyramid is such that it does not permit bacteria to live. It basically is a place where those life forms do not resonate. They are dissonant with the background field of the pyramid in the torsion model.
But this is nothing you can measure, is it?
Oh, this is not an energy.
Yes, it is.
It's because Kozarev built a whole bunch of detectors. David Wilcock has built detectors. You know, there's a very famous Russian guy that I don't have in front of me now. I will after the top of the hour, who did a whole bunch of experiments, it turns out, with bees, who wasn't part of the Russian torsion field physics community. He was a separate Russian guy who just was an entomologist. He was just into bees. And he discovered that there was a peculiar radiation that would even penetrate brick walls and structures and all that, whereby the bees were actually using this resonant honeycomb field effect to find their way home. And there are replicable experiments, Art, and they will all be in the series of papers we're putting up starting tonight or tomorrow, going through the coming week.
All right. Can you you say they put together detectors that can detect whatever this energy is?
Yes.
Which should mean that you can tell me what kind of detectors they are and what kind of energy it is.
Yep. Okay. Well, I can't do it in 2 minutes. But
well, no. That's all right. You don't even have 2 minutes. All right. Very good. My guest is Richard C. Hoagland, and he thinks he's got his thumb on the bee problem. It is true that organic bees are not affected. The ones carted about for the big industrial mid-farmland that we have and for pollination, these are the ones that are affected. We've learned that much. Richard thinks it has something to do with the construction of the hives and a new energy that we'll talk more about. We'll be right back. Here I am. All right, so Richard appears to be saying that there is a new physics and energy which he says has been detected and measured, which we're going to talk definitely about in a moment, which is affecting the bees. Now, why this energy is suddenly present and why this year it's beginning to affect bees that have been basically doing the same dance for a couple of hundred years, We're going to find out. Stay right there. Well, all right, Richard, I can measure energy. I can measure audio energy. I can measure it down so far that I can hear the grumblings of the earth, if I so desire. I can measure radio frequency energy above that, right on up into the microwave range. And then above that, of course, into light. Now, where does the energy that you're talking about fit in?
Well, it's measurable energy like any other energy. And the way that Kozarev and the other Russian scientists who've been working with us, as I said, for at least 50 years, if not longer, have been measuring it, is in physical effects, primarily with what are called torsion pendulums, which is one of the reasons why it's called torsion field physics. What happens is, what Kozarev discovered in the 30s and 40s was that if you have a rotating system or a vibrating system, mm-hmm. like a gyroscope in a laboratory, and it's rotating, spinning on its axis very fast, mm-hmm. and then you shake it at another angle, like, for instance, remember those little childhood gyros we used to get where you'd spin them up with a string?
Sure.
And they would sit on your finger and tilt at a strange angle, and they appear to defy gravity?
Yes.
Well, he found that if he took one of those and produced two simultaneous motions, one was the spin of the gyro, and the other was to vibrate it, mm-hmm. to make it move through space at some other angle, back and forth. And he had a torsion pendulum, which is a very finely balanced rod sitting on a very, very precise knife edge, so that it will swing at the slightest movement of force. Like if you were to blow on it, it would really whirl around.
Right, I've got it. Okay.
And he would put this in a vacuum bell several meters away, even behind walls, that when he vibrated the spinning gyro, the torsion pendulum would rotate around almost like a locator beacon, one of those old-fashioned radio locator beacons where the antenna would focus on the source of radio waves.
Right.
And it would unerringly point to where the gyro was vibrating.
Hmm.
And he realized that there was a physics, theoretical physics, underlying this that went all the way back to 1913 to a guy named Dr. Elie Cartan, who came out after Einstein's relativity and produced an additional set of theories that were trying to, refine relativity in terms of the properties of space-time, and it became known as the Einstein-Cartan theory, and it predicted that there would be these waves that would be radiated by spinning systems, mm-hmm. as part of deformed space-time predicted by Einstein's theory.
So are you suggesting that the spinning Earth is beginning to jiggle?
It's everything is spinning. They're all jiggling, and it's the interaction of all the rotating masses that are changing their frequency, that are detectable by torsion of detectors that are basically also spinning systems. You have to have a system which is capable of rotation in order to detect this, and it shows up as mechanical changes. And there are 10,000 papers that have been written in the last 50 years by about 100 physicists, 100 guys, half of them in the Soviet Union, hidden by the KGB, deliberately kept secret until the wall fell down, and then we got all this stuff flooding out from the old Soviet files, that are incredible laboratory examples of physicists in all different walks of background in life doing experiments. They've now built torsion field generators that actually can produce signals on demand. David built a very crude torsion detector out of a monofilament and a burn match. And the reason the match is important is because what is the most likely component of a burn match? It's carbon. And what is the molecular structure of carbon? It's tetrahedral. It all goes back to this fundamental hyperdimensional geometry. Now, I cannot, even in 3 hours, minus the questions, on the radio, do adequate justice to this incredible body of work that I discovered that is so complementary to what I've been saying for years and years and years. But fortunately, that's where we have the web. So what we're going to do in the next few days is to start publishing part 1, part 2, part 3 of this unified physics with the references to the actual papers and experiments that people out there who are, you know, kind of garage tinkerers can actually do. You can do this at home. It's perfectly safe, and you will discover amazing things. Now, bottom line, it turns out that the antenna on the bees are torsion field antenna. That's why, if you look at bees, look at and any insects, by the way, use the same technology, except they don't build geometric honeycombs and houses, so they're not their living environment is not as radically affected by whatever the change is in this background radiation field, this torsion field that has gone on and is going to continue to go on and get different. Because I believe it's a frequency change. Here's why I think it's a frequency change.
Well, I was about to ask you, even with the method you described of being able to detect this force, that doesn't mean that you've actually measured it and understand how it's operating. It means you've detected it. You can see it there. But how are they able to measure the change in frequency and attribute it to the problem with the bees?
Well, they are not working. The torsion field guys are probably not even aware that there is a relationship between the torsion field physics and the bee problem.
Okay.
That requires generalists like me and David and others. All right. When we publish this, because the web goes all over, and we're going to make some calls to some of the key leading torsion field guys like Chipov, who was one of the leading lights now in the Soviet Union and in Russia, we're going to get them looking. And there's a whole separate study of honeycombs and how they are interacting with the torsion physics that was done by, as far as I know, only one guy. He's now dead. He was elderly. He was an iconoclast. He was your typical lone genius. You know, he pioneered the idea that bees and honeycombs were doing something that could be detected by detectors. But when he died, nobody picked up on his work. We have it on the web. It'll be part of the references in this series of references in the papers, and people can, you know, come to their own conclusion. The key thing here is it makes predictions. And one of the predictions is, going back to why we got two separate bee tracks a couple hundred years ago between the commercial producers and the organic producers. The commercial producers, for economic reasons, tried to make bigger bees by making bigger honeycomb.
Right.
The organic guys, you know, with the God is beautiful, nature knows everything, they've stuck like a religion with the natural bee order, even though they try to systematize it, and it turns out that's also not a good idea. What people in industry try to do is they try to follow Henry Ford and make things uniform, and it turns out the bees don't like uniform. Bees, in fact, build alternating size honeycomb in a natural environment that has the shape, get this, Art, of a tetrahedron.
Right.
And there will be images on our articles showing these natural, beautiful honeycombs where you have large honeycomb at the top, something like 5.9 millimeters across for each of the six-sided hexagonal cells. And at the very bottom in the core, where the egg laying goes on at certain parts of the year, and we'll get to that in a minute, it goes all the way down to about 4.6 millimeters. Now, the average person might say, wait a minute. What's the difference between a 5.9 millimeter and a 4.6 millimeter honeycomb? Why should a bee care about that little change, that little size change? It cares if the honeycomb is like a tuned resonant receiver. Art, and you of all people should understand what tuned receivers do. And it doesn't take much of a change in an antenna to throw you off frequency.
That's right. I'm willing to concede the torsion physics possibility. I'm willing to concede the measurement you talked about. What I don't think that you've proven is that there's been a frequency change and that specifically that has affected the bees.
Okay. Well, if one looks at this strictly in terms of the waves, if you have little guys living in a honeycomb of a certain size and the background field changes so that that frequency no longer is resonantly in step with
them, maybe they can't find their way home.
They can't. It doesn't resonate and create a signal.
I've got that. But
there's
what we haven't done is we haven't proven there's been a change in the frequency, or if we have, you haven't laid that out for us yet.
Okay. Well, one of the things that I've been doing since you and I have been apart and not talking to each other on the radio is I have carried out a series of experiments at Coral Castle, one of your favorite places.
Mm-hmm.
And it started when I had the heart attack, and Robin took me down there as part of my therapy, and I wandered around, and then she noticed on the wall one of the things that Ed Leeds Scanlon had left, which was basically a hexagon with two inscribed tetrahedra in it over his outdoor bathtub, which was kind of like a clear signal, this is the physics I'm using to build this place. So I've gotten very interested in Coral Castle. I took some ideas from my departed friend, Bruce De Palma, having to do with the Accutron watch. Remember the old Accutron watch?
Yes.
It had the little tuning fork?
Mm-hmm.
And I married up the Accutron with a computer program that lets me actually count the cycle, the frequency of the tuning fork, which is like a torsion pendulum. It vibrates back and forth. And remember, a vibration is a partial rotation. So my idea was, could the tuning fork in the Accutron be used as a detector of this torsion radiation?
Perhaps so.
And, well, the bottom line is absolutely 100% it is so. Because when I took it into Coral Castle, I've done it three times now we've done it more than three times because I was able to wire the castle and get months and months and months and months of long-term data during all different seasons and various celestial events. And you know, I've talked about alignments. It turns out the celestial alignments between spinning planets arcs create wonderful tremors in the force,
mm-hmm.
changes in the torsion field. And bottom line, I was able to replicably measure those changes. And those graphs, you know, will be part of our paper series that we're doing on this. I was able to, for instance, when Venus crossed the Sun, the once every 120-year transit of Venus,
mm-hmm.
where we have two of them 8 years apart. The next one is coming up in 2012. The first one was back in 2004. We got stunning results in the tuning fork sitting in the middle of Ed Leeds Scanlon's 1,100 tons of coral.
Mm.
Now, why is coral, i.e. limestone, important? Because it's like a huge, huge beehive, Art. The coral is deposited in hexagonal little crystals by the little organisms that make the oolitic limestone. And when you cut it up and stack it like Leeds Scanlon did, you basically create yourself a huge torsion amplifier. And putting my little Accutron in there with the computer attached, I was able to magnify the torsion signal. And when Venus crossed the Sun, we got stunning results showing that a spinning planet 25 million miles away, where you could cover it with your fingernail, even smaller than your fingernail, had a measurable effect on a tiny, you know, few gram mass vibrating pendulum in this little watch hooked up to a computer. I did it during a total eclipse of the Sun that was visible as a partial eclipse in Florida. Got the same effect, which replicated what Maurice Allais had inadvertently done with a torsion pendulum in Paris in 1954. And then I decided, was it possible that you could get rid of the castle? If the physics was changing the way I've been predicting, the waves are getting higher and higher, the amplitude of this is getting stronger as well as the frequency shifts, you should be able to do it without the castle. So I did it here during the transit of Mercury, and I had Robin literally looking at the computer screen as Mercury moved onto the surface of the Sun, blocking it from its
right.
close orbit.
Right.
And bingo, exactly when first contact occurred, when the edge of spinning Mercury, which is rotating every 59 days, reached the edge of the Sun, which is rotating backwards relative to Mercury at the equator 27 days, there was this stunning frequency increase, not by a lot, by a few hundredths of a percent, but the accuracy of the tuning fork combination of the Accutron and the computer is down to 1 or 2 parts per million, so it's way above signal to noise. And Kozarev said in his own calculations that these effects are on the order of 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 5th, meaning 1/10,000th to 1/100,000th of the normal background entropic, electromagnetic, gravitational, other forces that objects feel. But if you have a tuned system, meaning two resonant rotating systems, you can increase that signal so that you can detect them easily. And with computer technology now, they're easily measurable. What I haven't done yet, and what I'm trying to figure out a way to do, is to use the tuning fork and measure the beehives. Because my prediction is that the beehives that are happy and fine will have one set of frequencies that I can measure. And the beehives that are subject to this sudden, you know, colony collapse disorder, mm-hmm. where the bees leave because they can't stand their environment anymore. Does that sound kind of familiar to people in L.A. or New York? That those will have a different frequency, and it should be measurable with the same torsion-type detectors that Kozarev pioneered over 50 years ago.
And all of this, you think, is occurring simply because of the...
The change in the background frequency.
Which is made apparent by the change in the construction of the hive.
That's right. Now, it turned out that what, according to, there's a beekeeper whose name I'm not going to talk about on the air tonight because there's some very curious things going on around his activities. He lived in Wyoming. He's got an extraordinary site. We'll be linking the site in the papers. He had done like 15 years of research, 1,500 experiments with natural beekeeping versus commercial beekeeping, standard foundation. And what he discovered was that even the organic beekeepers have gotten bad habits from their commercial friends, in that although they're producing smaller honeycomb and smaller bees, which turn out to be incredibly resistant to the mite problem, when what he found was that any bee can be made to reproduce in any size honeycomb without change except in behavior. In the small honeycomb, the bees will clean the hive and eliminate the mites themselves. You don't have to fumigate. You don't have to put pesticides and fungicides and, you know, things that will attack the parasites. The bees do it themselves. You take those same bees and put them in the large honeycomb, they suddenly forget what to do. There's something in the torsion field which is basically reinforcing their behavior to be good housekeepers.
Okay, again, how long have we been using these larger hive constructions?
Hundreds of years. In fact, so, you know who the first guy was who was an astronomer who looked seriously into the size of honeycombs in terms of frequencies? Johann Kepler.
I wouldn't have guessed that.
Impossible to guess. Kepler, in addition to figuring out the orbit of Mars and elliptical planetary orbits, the huge breakthrough in physics that led to Newton and the theory of gravity, Kepler, remember, had another theory that no one ever took seriously, which he called the music of the spheres, the idea that rotating planets orbiting the sun had a natural etheric music that geometrically could be fit into their orbital parameters. And I think he got this idea, I can't say absolutely tonight, but I think based on some of the papers I've seen now, that he got this idea because he absolutely kept bees. And he wrote about bees and beehives and bee behavior, which was stunning to me. It has to do with being a multidisciplinary generalist, putting dots together of things you wouldn't think would connect. Bottom line, I think the physics is changing. The frequency, the background torsion field is changing on Earth. Due to both the alignment of the planet with the galactic center, the whole 2012 thing, and due to the fact that Pluto, which is this little guy in this very inclined orbit, 17 degrees, has moved between us and the galactic center right now. And remember, I predicted based on this physics that there are two unseen big planets out there somewhere. And it's all about the alignment and geometry. I've now proven with the Carl Castle work that when you line up a planet with the sun, you get changes in the torsion field.
All right. Hold it right there, Richard. Hold it. We'll be right back. Morning, everybody. Tomorrow night, Richard C.J. Somerville, who is a distinguished professor at Scripps Institution of Oceanography and a climate scientist, is going to be my guest. Very distinguished indeed, one of the top scientists in the area on what's going on with our atmosphere, with global warming and such, is going to discuss the effect of carbon dioxide, that which mankind is pouring into the atmosphere at a pretty great rate. Now, most of mainstream science right now is convinced, almost to the point of settled science, that this gas that we're putting into the atmosphere is indeed warming our planet. We just had a a forecast by NASA that by, what is it, 2080, we'll be in 100 to 110 degree mark in cities like Chicago, Washington, and Atlanta. I don't think too many disagree that the warming now is going on for years and years they did. Now, they're pretty much agreed. I think even Richard would agree the warming is going on. I don't think that he attributes it, though, to that gas. He thinks the warming is going on all the planets, and that probably weaves right back into what we were talking about with respect to the bees. That in a moment. Well, okay, a couple of quick things, Richard. First of all, am I right? Would you say that rather than the gases that we're putting into the atmosphere, you feel that not just Earth, but all the planets are warming, and you don't feel it's due to the gases that we're emitting, but rather some sort of uniform change in frequency, if you will, that relates right back to this?
Well, it's both. You know, I mean, there's a natural cycle that's going on all over the solar system that we can look at all the data. I mean, there's over 100 papers that we referenced in that first series we did back in 2004.
Yes.
NASA studies of warming and energy changes and phenomenology changes on planets all over the solar system. The most stunning one, of course, is Pluto. Pluto, as you know, is about 4 billion miles from the sun. It's no longer a planet. Sorry about that. It's leaving the sun. It is in an elliptical orbit, and ever since back in the 80s, it's been moving away from the sun, and that's why there was this big ferment in NASA for years and years and years to get a probe out there while it still had an atmosphere, while whatever atmosphere and global dynamics and weather that it had was still ongoing, because if you get the probe there too late, it takes, you know, like 10, 12 years to get there. If you arrive when the whole atmosphere is frozen out and has fallen on the ground as snow, then you basically have a dead, you know, ball of rock with some snow on top, and that's not very interesting. So the JPL guys that were trying to get behind the Pluto mission were really pushing the Congress and the president to get a mission funded to get out to Pluto while it's still warm enough that there'd be something interesting to observe when they got there. Well, something strange happened on the way to Pluto. As it's getting further from the sun and should be getting colder and colder and the atmosphere getting thinner and thinner and activity going lower and lower, in fact, it's exactly the opposite, Art.
Getting warmer.
It's getting warmer. There's more atmosphere. It's fluffier. There's clouds. There's weather. There's changes in light. There's all kind of, and by the time, you know, the New Horizon mission gets there in a few years, the end of this decade, it'll be an amazing place. The only problem being, where is the energy coming from? Because a quick calculation shows you that if it was coming from the sun, which is the latest, model in vogue, the latest fad, that, you know, all these planetary changes we talked about 3 years ago are basically the sun is doing it. If the sun was making Pluto warmer, then you and I would not be having this conversation, because the life on Earth would be extinct. The sun would have to be so warm to warm Pluto up to the extent that it is.
That we'd be boiling.
Pluto is my canary in the mine for the hyperdimensional model, that there's something bigger going on than SUVs. Yes, we on Earth have done very dumb and stupid things and continue to do them, and we should do a lot of the things to get not really, you know, cheaper SUVs and more efficient fossil fuel, you know, mechanisms. We need a radically different energy source. We need to stop emitting carbon dioxide and other, you know, fossil fuel emissions, period. But even that won't solve the problem, because the background physics is changing. So I'm not against the global warming people, the ones that say it's us that are the problem. Mm. We're just not the whole problem. We're, in fact, probably a small part of the problem. I listened carefully to your climatologist the other night. She made some good points. But what she's not taking into account is that this is going on all over the solar system, and it's all in consonance with our little canaries in the mine, to mix our metaphors here again, the bees. The bees are telling us there's something radically going on that's not man-made.
Richard, if it is the alignment, the spin, the wobble,
it's all of
the alignment of the planets, whatever, then it seems to me that's very far out of our control. And so if we take the leap and we assume that you're correct, and this is what's going wrong with the bees, then Robert in Anaheim asks, will you please lay down, if you believe all this to be true, what you think the solution to the bee problem is?
The solution is so simple for the bees.
Okay.
Solution is to simply go back to natural organic hives. You can make organic hives on a corporate scale, but you got to let the bees define your geometry. The organic hives, they don't care if they're moved. They don't care if they're mites. They are incredibly, I mean,
wait, Richard, wait.
Yes?
If that's true, then, again, you have not defined, you've said these hive changes have been here for a couple of hundred years. So, again, you haven't proven what has changed in this last year.
Okay,
versus the last couple of hundred years.
Let me try to do an analogy, okay?
Sure.
I'm trying to describe a spiral staircase without waving my arms, which on radio is hard.
Right.
So what I want everybody to do is I want them to close their eyes. Listening to radio, closing your eyes is good. I want you to imagine a large, flat pond, a still evening just after sunset where you have twilight. You've got, there isn't a breath of wind, and the pond is absolutely glassy smooth, okay?
Okay.
And you've got some balls out there. Think of them as tennis balls or ping pong balls or whatever, and they're scattered around, okay? And somehow you've got little motors in them, and you start them rotating. And what will happen is you will have waves spreading out from each of these little spinning balls.
Yes.
And the waves will interact with each other.
Yes.
Now, how will they interact? They will create ripples. The ripples will have a wavelength, in other words, between crest to crest to crest.
Sure.
And they will have an amplitude.
Sure.
If I have another, let us make a detector for this. Let's say we've got a little special ball which has a light in it, okay? And we toss it out on the pond, and the sun is setting, and it's getting dark, and now we can't see the pond or the ripples, so we don't know what's going on. All we see is our one little ball with the light in it, and what do we observe? We know, because we saw it in daylight, that we've got all these ripples going back and forth, interfering, interference patterns, the amplitude's getting bigger, smaller, the wavelength changing. But all we see of our little lighted ball is it's going up and down, up and down.
Mm-hmm.
And it changes going up and down erratically. Sometimes it sits almost still. Other times it's violently jerking up and down, a little bit from side to side. And what we have to do is mathematically piece together the invisible model of the waves causing the motion of our lighted detector in the dark. That's what we're dealing with in torsion field physics. We have to make detectors that respond to these invisible waves. Life itself, it turns out, is fundamentally based on torsion field interactions. That's why insects have those antennae. They are tuned torsion wave detectors in this model. And the bees have been building comfortably for millions of years natural size honeycomb that responds to the changes in the background physics. When the artificial guys came in and forced them all to live in one size honeycomb, that was fine for the last couple hundred years, Art, when there was no real change going on in the physics. But as we opened the show, you wrote the book, you called it The Quickening. When the background changes, when the environment is no longer the way it used to be, you either adapt or die. And the natural bees are living in a variety of size honeycombs, and they simply move from one part of their hive to another, and they're perfectly happy. The artificial guys, the ones, the corporate ones, that are forced to live in the big honeycomb with the fixed rigid cell size, it's too big for the frequency passing through the hive, it is actually making them sick and driving them away, and they can't find their way home, and millions are disappearing every day.
Okay, when I wrote the book, I did it, as I told you earlier in the program, based mostly on intuition and observation, Richard, that events were cascading and were speeding up. Now, I did not prove that there was some great change going on in the universe, in our solar system, with the rotating bodies of planets beginning to create a different frequency. I suppose it amounts to the same thing, but I didn't prove anything scientifically, and I'm not altogether sure that you have either. What you've got to prove here is the actual change in frequency that's resonating in these hives.
The way we will do that is with measurements. As I said, I need to find myself a local bee guy you know, a commercial guy and an organic guy, and I need to sit them down and I need to say, can I measure the frequencies as this physics is changing and just see what we see? I know I've got a measurable system that is measuring this physics, and in terms of celestial alignment stuff, it's astonishing. It is so incredibly in keeping with the predictions of what we thought we could see, over and above what Marie Salle saw back in 1954. You know, he was the Nobel laureate in economics who actually wanted to be an astronomer and did all these astronomy and physics measurements of pendulum motions and all that.
Yes.
And during the eclipse in Paris in 54, he discovered that during a solar eclipse, when the moon comes between the Earth and the sun, he got a sudden shift in the pendulum motion that was completely unpredicted, completely contrary to anything Newton or Einstein or anybody else has written, that in fact is torsion. It's got to be torsion. It's the only thing that's left. So if you relate his work to Kozyrev's work and Shipoff's work and all the other guys that have written these 10,000-plus papers, there is a huge body of peer-reviewed mainstream science that's been kept from the Western physicist by design, basically, because the torsion field, if you really get into it, Art, torsion field physics gives us anti-gravity, it gives us space propulsion, it gives us free energy, it gives us the keys to the kingdom. And there's a few folks here that wouldn't want this society to have all that, so they really don't want us talking about much of this. And it's useful tonight that we're able to have this discussion and people can begin their own observations in their garages.
All right, but in the meantime, to solve the B problem, it's your contention they would merely have to change the construction of the hives and go back to the way it was.
Exactly. Now, you can scale that up to industrial size. You can take hives.
Right.
You can cart them around.
Sure.
Because the natural hives are happy. They're pest-free. But now we're getting into something that is almost like a religion, Art, because you have these two groups intensely polarized. And I found out how polarized when I started going through the web articles and the web papers and the blogs between the two groups. There was a guy who tried to mediate between them, and both groups turned on him like he was the enemy, because he was saying you don't have to be the strict purist in terms of organics. You can actually, you know, you don't have to suffer huge diebacks when you go from the large comb back to the small comb, because the hives lose something like 70 to 80% of their population when you do that, you know, which for a commercial beekeeper would be catastrophic.
Sure.
This guy was able to make the transition by going to the multiple sizes with very minimal losses, 5%, 6%, something like that. So that's usually what beekeepers sustain during a winter-summer season. One of the things that was so interesting and how this relates to Kozyrev is Kozyrev found in his torsion experiments that at certain times of the year, as we orbit the sun on this spinning planet, his experiments worked fine. Other times of the year, he couldn't make them work at all. Now, what does that
science
about?
Really hates that.
Huh?
Science really hates
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. That's what killed cold fusion. That unless you have the conditions right, just right, and the conditions are changing. I mean, cold fusion, by the way, is a torsion field phenomenon. You probably already suspected that, okay? Anyway, Kozyrev found that during the fall and winter, the experiments worked wonderfully. Mm-hmm. During the summer, they worked not at all. Well, this bee guy, this organic beekeeper who's done these 15 years of experiments with different hive sizes and different cell sizes, found that in a natural honeycomb, the bees make different size comb, and they inhabit them at different times of the year, and they grow and they shrink in terms of the future generations, dependent on the seasons. A natural hive has a natural growth and diminution of bee size based on the size honeycomb they prefer to live in at that particular month.
Mm.
And this is replicable year after year after year, and he's trying to tell both of these sides, the commercial guys and the organic guys, wait a minute, you both have a piece of the puzzle, and they're not talking to each other, and they basically ostracized him and drove him out of the business. So our hardest problem is not to solve the problem. It's going to get these guys to sit down with each other and talk to each other and basically have a conversation where, for the benefit of everybody, they drop their preconceptions, they look at the data, and they start doing something different. Remember the old definition of insanity.
Well, there's nothing like bankruptcy to get you talking.
hopefully they'll talk before they get to bankruptcy.
Well, they've got to be close. If the numbers we're hearing about are anywhere near correct, Richard,
then I think they're on the low side, Art. I think we're getting filtered corporate media, and people don't want everybody to know how bad it really is. That's why you're getting all these theories that come out.
As you know, it's in Europe as well. It's not just here.
Now, get this. It's only in the Northern Hemisphere. Did you know that?
I think I did. I know that Australia has no such problem.
Nope, and South America, and, you know, now why is that? Because it turns out from Kozyrev's work that the torsion field physics based on a spinning Earth is asymmetric. The Northern Hemisphere is different in the rotating frame than the Southern Hemisphere.
Okay.
And, I mean, there is no way I can, in a few minutes on the radio, describe the stunning litany of experiments that reinforce this whole idea. My job tonight is to get people curious enough, excited enough, you know, uncertain enough to go and want to research further. Go to the web. Don't even go to Enterprise. Go look up, you know, Google yourself. Start organic bees, cell size honeycomb, Nicholas Kozyrev, torsion field physics. It's all there. We have this stunning tool called the World Wide Web. Use it, people. Do your own homework. It'll take you just a few days to discover some amazing things. And the bottom line is you're going to come out exactly where I've come out, in that there's some background environmental thing which suddenly changed, and it has to do with the frequency matching into the size of the comb, and that's why the commercial bees are abandoning their homes.
Now, Richard, other than the bees, what else do you think it's affecting?
Well, I think it's affecting everything. You know, remember, the bees are a frequency detector. The weather is an amplitude detector. Mm-hmm. You talked with Evelyn before about energy?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, why do you think the coming solar cycle, 24, is going to be a mind-boggler? It's because the amplitude of energy coming into the solar system, gating in from hyperspace, which is what is causing the ripples on the pond, that's where the energy is coming from, is opening wider and wider, and the amplitude of energy is getting higher and higher, and the frequency is going up. That's where your quickening comes in. And this affects, you know, a whole cascade of systems, not just weather. It affects sun, solar activity. It affects consciousness. Have you been noticing unusual sociological things lately in you know, when you watch television, when you watch, you know,
yes,
basic events?
Yes, it's part of what I call the quickening.
Yeah.
Sure.
Have you noticed, for instance, that people seem to be more and more unable to lie? It's kind of like that Jim Carrey movie. They will blurt out, look at the Don Imus thing, all right? Look at what happened with Al Sharpton a few days ago.
Oh, yes.
Look at, I mean, it's like, it, you know, the politic thing to do when you're a public person is to look at Baldwin with his daughter.
All right.
I'm seeing a change in social behavior across the board where we're basically more impulsive. And there are more impulsive explosions of emotion.
Richard, if the ability to lie leaves us, then truly we are near the end of the world. Hold it right there. We'll come back and open the phone lines. This should be interesting. Richard C. Oakland is my guest. I'm Art Bell. I certainly am a creature of the night, and I guess Richard is now too. I follow and can embrace the torsion field physics aspects of what Richard has said tonight. It absolutely makes sense. It really does make sense. And even in the limited manner in which it's been able to be measured, I follow along. Now, what I don't think has been proven is the direct effect on the bees and the change in frequency. I don't think that the measurements have been refined, the measurement techniques have been defined clearly enough and well enough to measure the fact that it actually has changed, and then another jump, that is what has affected the bees. But that's just my take on it. We'll be right back. Richard, is it the change in torsion field physics, change in frequency, that has caused you to get an email address?
What, on the website?
Yeah, I hear you've got an actual email address now.
Well, you know, I wanted to stay with faxes because I wanted to give people a little incentive to actually really want to communicate, not just nonsense. But so many people are so lazy these days, it's so easy to touch a button and send it electronically. So we do have an Enterprise Mission website, a website address email address on the website, yes.
Okay, good. Now, I'm even willing to concede, Richard, that...
Well, I don't want you to concede what you don't get, so let me try one more.
No, I do get it. I'm willing to concede that these effects may be connected to even human behavior.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's one of the tenets of the model. Now, let's get back to bees for a second. The honeycomb is a tuned antenna.
Mm-hmm.
You, of all people, know what that is.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the Bell Lab experiment that won Wilson and Penzias the Nobel Prize for picking up the Big Bang background
radiation?
Yes,
the radiation, yes.
That was that huge horn at Holmdel, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
The honeycombs are like little horn antennas. And depending upon the size, and we're talking here tenths of a millimeter difference
mm-hmm.
between the big ones and the small ones, that tells us how tuned this background frequency is and how little it takes to go from where they're happy to where they're disappeared, where they're gone.
Right.
And
right. But what bothers me, Richard, right, but what bothers me is that for 200 years we've been doing
because
this.
Because the physics didn't change.
And it has just recently changed.
The physics didn't change. Remember, it's a plateau, and then at the end it goes up asymptotic through the roof.
Well, right. The physics has not changed, but you're claiming that the physics, the frequency has changed.
The frequency and the physics are together. When I say physics, I mean frequency. They are both together. Let me read you something quick here, because this was so amazing in my research on this, and so correlative. Let me kill that little sound there for a second. The beekeeper, remember the one I said that was ostracized by both sides who did all these incredible 1,500 experiments, who basically got the database?
Oh, yes.
We'll be linking him in the paper, and you can go through all his experiments and see exactly. He's got amazing data on this site. Anyway, he has a section called Mysterious Hive Song. When I saw that, I mean, I'm going to try to play something on the radio for you. The bees appear to be singing in tune with the torsion field. Isn't that cool?
Yes.
Listen to this. He says, we know they dance, but do they sing? I've recorded an unusual hive sound. Only three times in my life have I heard this sound. It's not the common zip-zip of the queen piping. It's more like a repetitive, staccato, hyper-cat purring sound.
Okay.
And it's loud and very unique. Here are the details. Okay. He says, while working in a large commercial bee yard, I first heard a hive making an unusual sound. I planned to carefully inspect the hive, but before I could, the hive was disturbed and the sound stopped. And then I looked in the hive. I couldn't find anything unusual. The sound was so loud and unique that I didn't think the bees were producing it. I thought a critter had got inside the hive.
Mm-hmm.
I heard this same sound a second time while working queen-rearing hives many years later. This time the situation was different. Unlike the first encounter, where a single hive was just one of thousands worked never to be seen again, I worked these hives every few days. I knew these hives individually. Again, thinking a critter was in the hive, I promptly set out to discover what it was. While gently removing the cover, the sound stopped. So keeping an eye on the hive entrance to prevent any intruder from escaping, I carefully removed a frame from the top super. After inspecting it, I set it aside. Then I inspected each frame inside the top super, nothing. So I removed the top super, upended it, and set it on the ground next to the hive. The sound momentarily resumed. It was definitely coming from the remaining unexplored super, but it wasn't nearly as loud as before. I repeated the process, again watching the entrance for any escapees. As before, the sound stopped. I completely dismantled the hive and found absolutely nothing. So thinking the critter must have escaped, I put the hive all back together. Then a most unusual thing happened. The sound, though much fainter, started again. It came from the first super I had pulled. It was still on the ground beside the hive. Ha ha, I thought, I got you now. So I carefully lifted the upended super, set it down on top of an adjacent hive. The sound stopped. I carefully inspected the super without removing any frames. Again, nothing. So I watched and waited. About 15 minutes later, I decided to put the hive back together. Then as I was putting the hive together, a most unusual thing occurred. The sound started again. It was soft and localized in a small area of the bottom super. I set the top super on it. The sound volume increased. It gradually spread throughout the bottom box into the lower portions of the top box. There were bees making the sound. Amazing creatures, I thought, and wondered what the sound meant. I closed up the hive. A half dozen years passed, Art. This is interesting. I set up a hive with a plexiglass inner cover in my backyard. I monitored it several times a day. After returning from work, as I rounded the corner of the house, I heard that sound again. I was 75 feet away from the hive and immediately knew what it was. Oh, my gosh, I thought. I ran to the hive, and sure enough, it was the hive making the same sound. I carefully backed away, not wanting to disturb them. Then I began a frantic search for a way to record it. What happened to all those old cassette tape recorders anyway? Surely my teenage son, who's steeped in electronic gadgetry, has a means of recording sound. Not so. I couldn't believe it. Would I have time to rush to a box store and buy something before the bees switched gears? Then I remembered a feature on my digital camera. I had never used it and couldn't even remember how to use it. The camera could record small video clips with sound. So out came the camera and the manual. I carefully set the camera on top of the hive and recorded the sound. It just didn't do justice, though. I think the daytime sound just overwhelmed the camera's minuscule microphone, but it was the best I could do. By mid-afternoon, the sound stopped, and I haven't heard it in any hive since then. So here it is. Listen carefully. It's not the squawking bird or the barking dog or the car. I'm a little dismayed the bee sound, which is so loud, sounds muted in this recording. If you have trouble discerning it, try turning up the volume on your computer speakers. Listen to the night sound first, as the sound at lower tempo helps. And then he asks his other bee guys, have you ever heard anything like this? So let's try and see if I can do this, okay?
Sure, sure.
I think they're resonating to the torsion field change that occurred. And you know when he last heard it?
When?
November 2006. Huh. Which is when the bee collapse started.
Okay, by the way, Richard, Eric in Hawaii says, last week, Linda Moulton Howe reported the honeybee hive collapse disorder has now been reported in the Southern Hemisphere, specifically Brazil.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
All right, listen, I've got a lot of people who want to ask questions, so let's get to that. Pat in Maui, on Maui, actually, you're on with Richard.
Hey.
Hey.
Hi there.
Hi, my name's Pat, and I work at a proteoform up here in Kula, up on Haleakala, and the bees are just everywhere. They sit on my shoulders, they're all over my glasses. They really, truly are here.
Okay, Pat, turn your radio off. That's
okay.
Very important.
Hang on.
Well, of course, she's at 19.5 on the global grid, Art.
Yes.
You don't laugh about that. It's a part of this set of data.
So you're suggesting that somebody at 19.5 wouldn't have the problem?
Depending upon whether they're commercial or natural hives and the size of the comb and the resonant frequencies. I mean, this whole model goal fits together. It's testable. I'm not trying to prove this tonight. I'm trying to put an idea out there so others can help prove
right.
it.
Right, right. No, I'm with you there. All right, so, Pat, you have a lot of bees.
And they're so nice.
They're nice.
You don't know where they come from, though, right? You don't know whether they're organic-grown bees or natural bees or...
Well, they've been here forever.
Uh-huh.
We're out here on the rock, yeah.
Well, Hawaii is a very special place at 19.5.
Yeah, it is. And,
Okay, Pat, we appreciate it. Bees in Hawaii. Doreen in Northern California, you're on with Richard Hoagland.
Hi.
Hi.
This is Doreen. I thank you very much for taking my call. Your last statement before the break, Richard, was telling the truth. And I'm finding that to be quite true in my hemisphere, if you will. I want to know what you believe to be the most important and significant part of our history and truth at this point. I believe the politicians are going to start spewing things that they never thought would come out of their mouths.
Yep.
I'll take your answer on the air.
I really think you're on the same wavelength I am, keeping the metaphor going tonight. I have actually coined a little kind of term for this, you know. The good are getting better, and the bad are getting worse. If we're looking at a physics which is basically driving inclinations, then the people who are on that side of the equation, looking toward the light, looking toward, you know, service to others, looking toward beyond themselves, they are becoming better. And the other guys, I mean, as tragic as it sounds, I think that Evelyn is absolutely right, because I see Virginia Tech as a sequence of these people who are driven basically mad by internal problems that they cannot handle, they cannot control, and it's going to come out violently, and we need to be prepared to deal with this in a proactive, preemptive way before it gets out of hand. But if this is part of a background, think of it, Art, as a frequency-tuned matrix where various predispositions are encouraged. It doesn't mean we have to do it. We have to follow them. We are still masters of our own destiny and captains of our soul, but most people, they flow along the river as opposed to, you know, driving upstream.
What I'm thinking of, Richard, is a lot of our politicians joining Don Imus, wherever he presently
yeah.
is.
Yeah. You're going to see, I mean, look at the things that are coming out of people's mouths that you would never expect.
Yes. Adam in Akron, Ohio. Time for something to come out of your mouth. Hi.
Good morning, gentlemen. I bring you greetings from the denizens of Coast to Coast Channel on Undernet IRC.
Okay.
My question for you, Mr. Hoagland, is in two parts. It's referring to what you were discussing earlier about honeycombs and torsion wave energy.
Mm-hmm.
My first question is, would it be possible to build a very large honeycomb and thereby use its power to, say, torture or kill a terrorist, a human being? Put a human being inside a massive honeycomb and use the torsion energy to deal with them. Perhaps these terrorists, we could do something with them. My second question is, I have an entire box of honeycomb cereal in my pantry, and I'm now concerned about eating the cereal. Now, do you think that it's safe to eat the honeycomb cereal, or do you think I should throw it out?
Throw it out, huh?
Yep.
And the terrorist?
I don't think that was a serious question.
I don't either. But, all right, we'll leave it at that. Rick in Toronto, Canada, you're on with Richard.
Hi, 6:40 a.m. Richard, do you think this is the canary with the precursor for an ice age coming in 2012? The bees are migrating to areas that they can survive in, meaning they're leaving areas that will be too cold for them to survive in.
Well, remember, that was just an idea that Art threw out a couple hours ago. We have no data that the bees are migrating anywhere. We haven't had a set of calls from Canada saying, wait a minute, what are all these bees doing coming across the border without their passports?
While that is true, Richard, it is reasonable, I suppose, to speculate that if we're going to see Chicago go up 10 degrees, and that process is actually underway right now, it may well be that an insect, a very sensitive insect, might detect this prior to our beginning
well,
to sweat about it.
The problem literally. With that whole model is this started in November 2006, and in November it's getting pretty cold in North America. So it wasn't when it's getting to be summer, it's when it was getting colder. And instead of going north, you'd expect they would go south. And no, there's been no reports of migrations. They just disappear. And I think it's because they can't find their way back, and then they die individually. I mean, again, do the numbers. Spread out even millions of bees over a few square miles.
You might not see them.
And you're not going to notice anybody.
Okay. Jeff in Kent, Washington, you're on with Richard.
Hi, Richard. Have you ever heard of the miticide hyvastin?
No.
Okay. Well, it's a very new miticide. In fact, it's the first year of the use of this miticide. And it's not being used in all the states yet, but it's being used in many states, including Washington, and I have not been able to find many bees around here.
Now, I would imagine the very first thing the scientists would look for would be anything that has just started to recently be used, coinciding with, the disappearance of the bees.
Well, that would be the logical thing, and I know there have been some attempts in the last few weeks for various studies and study groups to come up with some, normal, mainstream, logical extrapolation.
Yeah, in any forensic examination, you would first ask, what has changed?
Yep. And my model is, it's the background environment. It's the physics, stupid.
Okay, John in Westminster, Colorado, you're on with Richard Hoagland.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out something. When somebody engineers something in life and then they give out the instructions on how to maintain it, usually you wouldn't consider a person very wise that ignored it, and the device wouldn't usually last that long. Well, the problem is there's one guy, one being that designed everything, and that's being ignored. One of the things that's being ignored is crossing species with hybrid situations. But the other factors that I'm thinking about is before we had mass transportation and things were taken by wagon, usually beehives were only moved around within the county or within an adjacent county.
Mm-hmm.
And so the bees got acclimated to where they lived and their immune systems adjusted, and they didn't have much problem.
But again, caller, the mass transportation of bees, according to Richard, has been going on for a couple of hundred years.
Well, not in the way. I mean, he's absolutely right that as we progressed up the technological transportation curve,
further and further.
We've gotten semis, and the real carting around of bees for pollination purposes and all that started back in the 1950s with the standardized, Henry Ford approach to the standard.
But enough years ago, Richard.
Enough years ago that was the problem.
Right.
We would have seen it a long time. This happened suddenly in November. Now, this is telling me that there is a step function, that something changed suddenly in November. By the way, November is when hives are closing down and they're basically going to winter over and all that.
I couldn't agree more, and that's what they should be looking for. Hold tight, Richard. We're at the bottom of the hour. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. We're bringing the buzz to you right here, folks. This is a pretty interesting observation, if accurate. It's from Dave in San Jose, California, who says, look, why are 90% of wild bees gone? They're not limited by commercial hive size. Wild bees are practically extinct in Northern California. We'll put that one to Richard in a moment. I'm a million miles from being a bee expert, but Dave in San Jose, Richard, says about 90% of the wild bees are gone. That wouldn't make sense because wild bees would construct their own natural habitats, right?
Yeah, they do. The problem is we've completely wrecked the ecosystem in major parts of the farming communities. And the natural bees don't have any place to build their hives. And they can't compete with the mega corporation bees trucked in, who basically take all the food. You know, there the assembly line technique has worked to the detriment of the natural ecosystem. I know there's a study out of the University of West Virginia of West Virginia bees, and there the study says, and I will have this linked, of course, on the papers that we're putting out, that natural pollinators do 90% of the work in West Virginia of pollinating,
mm-hmm.
and that the artificial bees, the domesticated bees, certainly the corporate bees, are a very minor component of the whole ecosystem. So it varies radically from state to state and region to region, depending upon how we've assiduously changed the environment to fit the corporate model.
It sure seems like this is spreading exponentially.
Yep.
And it's frightening, Richard. It really
is. Well, that's why we got to get a handle on it. And see, again, if it weren't for the fact that we've got empirical examples, theory aside, toss my idea tonight in the ash can if you want. The fact is that natural organic bee farmers and natural bee communities, hives, colonies,
mm-hmm.
are doing stunningly well with zero problems.
Right.
And these other guys are having the huge hits. And just on economics and empiricism alone, the corporate guys have got to start talking to the natural guys. Otherwise, we're all not going to be long for the
planet. Well, I certainly agree with that. Ken in San Francisco, you're on with Richard.
Good morning, Art and Richard.
Hi.
I want to... Richard struck a resonant chord with me when he said connecting the dots. I caught part of George's show, I believe it was, talking about Planet X. And what hit me was that's like tossing an extra rock in the pond, which could account for change in frequency.
Well, planets are involved. Alignments are involved. I have measured these alignments. I absolutely have replicable science. It's so incredible to sit here and watch in real time the effect on a little tiny, you know, Accutron watch on my desk when Mercury crosses the sun, which, by the way, Art, it did in November, and that's when my beekeeper heard that sound the last time.
Right.
I've got to go and see his time fact because he's meticulous in his recording, and I have to go back through the site and look and see if the other times he recorded that strange sound. What did you think of that sound coming from the hive?
It was interesting. I don't know that it translated very well on the radio, Richard.
I know, because you're missing all the low frequencies.
Right, exactly.
You know, going
right.
through a phone system, it's what, 5,000 hertz?
At best, more like 3 probably. Anyway, Richard, look, it's interesting. I bought the whole torsion field physics concept and its effect on virtually everything. Again, I'm not sure that, that you've proven a change in frequency, and then beyond that, that's what happened to the hives, but could be. Charles, in Osmond Beach, Florida, you're on the air with Richard.
Okay, that's Ormond Beach. It's a suburb
Ormond
of
Beach.
Daytona.
Sorry about that. Okay.
Yeah, I'd like to address my question to Mr. Hoagland's reference to the climate or the cyclical climate in the universe. I personally am intrigued by his reference to the physics. What was the kind of physics you mentioned? It was the
it's the field where the papers are all published is called torsion field physics.
Torsion physics. Now, you can laugh at me and you can throw eggs at me if you like, probably tainted with melamine from the chicken feed, but I am convinced I've had and still have the theory of everything and had it for years. Now, I find your torsion physics an element in that theory, and here's my question I pose to you. Can you see, and it's pretty profound, in the ever-expanding universe and Earth's participation as a piece of matter in that expansion, having a relation to the climate in the universe and, of course, subsequently a climate change on Earth right down to the bees?
Well, first of all, the universe is too big a canvas. The landscape we're talking about is the solar system, which is a central star orbited by 8 planets, one dethroned planet, and a bunch of other junk, and probably a couple of guys out there, you know, besides Sedna and what's her name, that we haven't found yet. And it's the orbiting rotations in this torsion field model that change the ripples, the three-dimensional ripples in the space-time fabric, in the ether, going on between all of these bodies, which interacts with everything in the system, including the biology going on here on planet Earth. And if there's biology on Mars, it would interact with that in the same way. Now, I know, because I've measured it, that these celestial alignments between spinning celestial objects changes this torsion field physics. I've been able to measure the actual changes on a computer screen. I've got screenshots. I'm putting them up. I've got them in papers. I've sent them to other colleagues. I'm going to put them as correlative evidence in this series of papers that we're going to put up in the next few days.
It's a fascinating field of research.
It's stunningly,
no question about it.
It's stunningly predictive and confirmatory. And the biggest part is that if you think, forget all the other planets, all right? Think of just the sun and the Earth, okay? And let's pretend that there's a galaxy with stars light years away. You know, the center of the galaxy, 26,000 light years away. It's got a 4 million solar mass black hole in it, right? That's the current theory?
Right.
Okay. I have been able to actually measure the torsion field effect of the center black hole in the Milky Way. And it's reproducible.
Okay.
It occurs every year around the winter solstice. That's when the Earth and the sun and the galactic center line up, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's when Kozyrev measured his maximum effect in torsion physics. That's when the bees, going back to my bee guy, measured the minimum size in the bees, because they go up and down in size depending upon the seasons. And the relationship of those seasons is measured relative to an exterior reference point, which is the galactic center. That's why the Mayans were and are so fixated on the galactic center, and why 2012, I believe, is more than just a date on a calendar. Mm-hmm. We're seeing the run-up. As in any physical resonance system, we're seeing the frequency changes as you run up the scale to a nodal point, to a peak arc. And this is all testable. That's what's so cool. Nothing I've said tonight, we can't back engineer, figure out. I mean, I can actually measure beehives and see if we get effects naturally. Then we can bring in some of the torsion field generators that the Russians actually were selling on the commercial market, a little gadget that fits on your desk the size of an old telephone.
Mm-hmm.
And you turn it on, it generates torsion waves, right?
Right.
Suppose we put that next to a beehive and we change the frequency and see what happens to the bees.
Either that or go back to the normal hive size and,
yeah.
You know, yeah.
And we correlate all of that.
Okay. Mary in Ohio, you're on with Richard.
Hello, Art and Richard.
Hi.
When you were discussing frequency changes, in addition to what's happening in the cosmos, what influence would HARP have on this, or even the government's experience, the military experience with low-frequency sound changes?
Okay, that's a very good question.
It's an exquisite question. Art, you've got one hell of an audience. You know, it's always been that. The best questions come from this audience. The answer is I don't know. Based on past work the Russians have done, there is some influence between electromagnetic waves and torsion waves, okay? There's not a lot because they're produced by two radically different processes. One can imagine a scenario where, for instance, I'll give you one scenario. I mean, she really is onto something here, because one of the things the Russians found is if you resonate plasmas, if you make plasmas jiggle in unison, you get torsion wave generation. So the thing is, HARP is a big heater of the ionosphere, right?
Yes.
Beams power up in a rhythmic frequency, whatever the megahertz range is. It jiggles the ionosphere, which is a plasma, and that jiggling ionosphere in turn generates torsion.
That's right.
Which could affect, I mean, this woman is a genius. She has figured out another potential thing we need to look at.
Well, HARP is using harmonics, subharmonics,
yep,
to get to very, very low frequencies that would operate in exactly the range you're talking about. Tony in Las Vegas, you're on with Richard.
Art, Richard, it's an honor to speak to both of you, and great to hear you both together. It's like a Beatles reunion. I pray we get to hear this more often, the two of you. I've listened since 1990 to Art and Coast to Coast. In all those years, Richard, I think the former caller, I was going to say something about that too, HARP playing a possibility in that. And Art, you broke that huge interview a couple of years back with the scientist from HARP. Mm-hmm. I think that does play a role. But I wanted to ask you, Richard, in all the years I've listened, I don't recall that I happened to catch a program where you explained how did you make the connection between the sort of Egyptian mystery science religions, Masonic, in the year, because you came from a secular background in news. How did you finally make that connection between the Egyptian sort of mystery Masonic 19.5 and connect that with NASA, the missions?
Oh,
and
God.
Please, if there's, I know it's not much time, but I would love to hear. I'll take that
whole
off
other
the air,
program.
Your answer on that.
That's really a whole other program. It's basically the numbers. You start looking at these numbers, and you know that there's a physics behind the 19.5 business and the 33. And then you realize that these other ritual systems are a fossilized encoding of the numbers without knowledge of what the numbers mean. This happens over and over again to human societies, where you start out with a body of knowledge and a bunch of people that know what they're doing. And then if you get too many generations down and you get things that are lost in between and manuscripts get lost and people die off and you've got wars and you've got, you know, migrations, the survivors, they have the outer form, but they've lost the core of what the knowledge means. So they simply go through the motions, and that's what we found in that other area. which, of course, is a whole other program, and that would kind of divert us tonight. I hope that, that answers the question.
Okay. Danny in Utah, you're on with Richard C. Hoagland.
Hi. I'm a first-time caller but long-time listener. I actually had a question about the mint plant and also it being involved with the bee's natural antibiotics and their ability to fight off, you know, the mites. They say are involved where the natural honeycombs actually don't allow these mites.
Well, look, this is not about chemistry. I think we're going to prove at the end of the day this is not about chemistry, and we've gone down that wrong road again. You know, pesticides, herbicides. You know, this is trying to figure out what the bees are trying to tell us and then following their lead. And what the experiments that this guy, you know, who did 1,500 of these and documented them with digital cameras and measurements and graphs. I mean, it's incredibly scientific and really understandable. He demonstrated
natural harmonics.
It's about harmonics, and it's about what happens when you put the bees in the smaller comb. They suddenly seem to remember behavior that they forget when they're in the bigger comb, and they start literally nipping these little mites in the bud. They seize them with their pincers, their jaws. And they crush them to death, and they fall out on the bottom of the honeycomb. And he has photographs showing the bottom floor filled with dead mites that have been attacked by the worker bees selectively cleaning the hive as behavior, which is what they're supposed to do. But when you put them in the bigger comb, they somehow develop amnesia. I think it has to do with triggering certain genetic DNA programmed instructions. It's like if you put the computer in the wrong area, or you feed it the wrong program, it doesn't do what it's supposed to do.
Sure.
And this has to do with, remember, bees are the most robotic biological analogs to man-made systems, to computer program systems that we have, that and ants. Ants don't build geometries. Bees build a stunning geometry. Why do you think, by the way, and this is a complete non sequitur, Art, but the previous caller made me think of it, why do you think we have a state in the Union called the Beehive State, which is Utah? And what's the predominant religion of Utah? Mormonism. And where do the Mormons get most of their rituals? From the Masons? I'll just leave it there and let people think about that.
All right. Joe in Merced, California. You're on with Richard.
Good morning, Art. I'm a first-time listener. And good morning, Richard.
Morning.
Hey, my question is, I had a geology professor years ago say that in the rock record, there's proof that the periodically the Earth will, its magnetic field, the polarity will change.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm noticing down here in Merced that the bees, now I've always thought that they've navigated using the Earth's magnetic field rather than this torsional wave energy or whatever.
Right.
And I'm noticing the bees here are very disoriented. In fact, I'm picking them up off the sidewalk and out of the back of the yard, and I'll hold them up and up into the sun, and then they seem to gather some energy, and then they head toward the sun, then they circle a number of times, and then they seem to take off in a direction. I'm wondering if somehow maybe with this planetary alignment and whatever, that the Earth is about to change its polarity.
Well, that's a big change, and yeah, that's one possibility, up to and including a physical flip of the pole. I mean, that's the worst-case scenario, that the physics actually... See, remember, torsion physics, if you start looking at the details, it's also about inertia. It's the key to anti-gravity, workable anti-gravity. In fact, one of the leading theorists, a guy named Gennady Shipoff, who is a good colleague and friend of Tim Ventura, who runs the American Anti-Gravity website, actually has a gadget, Art, which is a space drive, which actually produces unidirectional force through spinning motion of masses in this gadget based on the Kozarev original experiments. And one of my fond hopes is that I can prevail upon you to put me in touch with Bob Bigelow, and we put one of these gadgets in his inflatable Genesis space modules, and we turn it on, and we watch a non-rocket propulsion system based on torsion field physics
radically change the future of space travel. Interested?
Perhaps so. I'm sure you'd be concerned about what that might do to the spacecraft.
Well, it would change the orbit, so obviously you wouldn't want to keep it on. But the perfect, I mean, he's got, what, 20 cameras and stuff like that?
That's right.
And we're not going to get NASA to do it. We can't get the Russian space program to do it. Shipoff has been cut down by his own people. But if we went through, if I can get a gadget that would be space-rated to go in Bob's next flight, or the flight after that, and we can get this thing turned on and we watch it, and we watch the tracking, and you literally watch this torsion device change the momentum of his whole space station without rockets. Look, Ma, no hands, no rockets. This could be a stunning development that this whole discussion tonight has been pointing us toward, because the bees are trying to say something to us. They're trying to tell us, in a largest metaphorical sense, pay attention to the real physics of what we're functioning under.
There's no question they're trying to tell us something, all right. All right, Richard, anything you want to plug or get on very quickly, because we're about over here.
I just did it. My real art tonight is to try to get you to help me with Bob Bigelow to get Shipoff's torsion field generator, a unidirectional non-rocket propulsion system, into one of those space stations so we can watch it function in orbit and change the future of history.
Well, I know he's got a lot of launches coming up, Richard, so anything's possible. I'm sure he'd be concerned if he was convinced something would change the orbit of one of his spacecraft. He'd probably be somewhat concerned about it.
Well, you don't have to change it very much to be noticeable on the radio tracking.
That's absolutely true. All right, Richard, we're out of time. That's it.
Art, it has been a pleasure.
It has been a pleasure, and it's been a long time. We'll do it again soon, Richard. Take care.
Thanks, my friend.
All right.
And,
ladies and gentlemen,
have a wonderful anticipatory baby.
Coming up soon. Thank you, Richard, and good night. Everybody, see you tomorrow night. It'll be an interesting night tomorrow indeed. From the high desert, ciao.